I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author and newspaper columnist Judith Martin, also known to her many readers as Miss Manners. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Judith Martin. Born a perfect lady in an imperfect society, Judith Martin, a.k.a. Miss Manners, is the pioneer mother of today's civility movement. Whether your quandary involves fish forks or cell phones, a black tie wedding or a backyard barbecue, she can help you navigate the stormy seas of etiquette. Here's an example of why I love Miss Manners. Dear Miss Manners, I'm an average 14-year-old girl who has a problem. My mom won't let me wear thong underwear, and it's the kind I want to wear. My friends make fun of me for not wearing that type. I was wondering if you could help me convince my mom and tell her it is all right to wear them. Gentle reader, of all the advice columnists in the world, you chose Miss Manners as the one most likely to support the cause of thong underwear. And you wonder why your mother questions your judgment? Judith Martin's latest book, Miss Manners Minds Your Business, tackles the always messy workplace with the practical, pertinent, and utterly correct advice necessary to win the job, keep the job, and leave the job with sanity and dignity intact. Please join me in welcoming Judith Martin to the JCCSF.
Thank you very much. I am expected, I think, to grouse about modern manners, and yet I am a defender of American manners. I think American manners are really the best in the world in theory, not necessarily in practice. We have spread those ideas around the world, the dignity of labor. You know, we would never say, as the British do, so-and-so is in trade, and isn't that awful? We have the idea of treating everybody equally. I would prefer it if it were equally politely, and it's more likely to be equally rudely, but at least it's equal. And there have been improvements in the last few decades. Open bigotry was tolerated, and bigotry is still with us. I'm not Miss Morals. I wish she would work more on that, if there is such a person. I'm Miss Manners, but it's always challenged, and that is a big difference. One of the sports we native Washingtonians have is watching politicians self-destruct by not realizing that that change has come about. But I thought, okay, I will air some complaints about the state of modern manners. I'm not going to call them pet peeves. I don't like that term. I think pets should be amusing and affectionate. And I think people expect me to say that the biggest etiquette problem today is that people use the wrong fork. The silver forks were all melted down for World War I, so what I assume they mean by the wrong fork is those plastic forks that break when you put them in the meat. But it would be nice if people could learn to eat without disgusting others, I admit. And what do you have more practice at in your life than eating? And you'd think people would be able to get it right, but no. However, as I say, that is not the chief etiquette problem today. The chief etiquette problem is greed, is unabashed begging on the part of people who are far from indigent. And I don't know if you've been targeted about this, but I hear about it all the time, and not just from the people who are targeted. I get it from people who are confident that if they write to me, I will tell them a nice way to practice extortion. And they put it in terms of a dream, my dream wedding. I dream of giving a special present to my husband or wife. I dream of paying off the mortgage or surprising the parents on their anniversary by giving them a fancy trip or just a gala evening at an expensive restaurant with their friends. So that's the first dream. The second dream is to get someone else to pay for it. And that's what I'm asked about. And I let her from a woman who said money's very tight, but she'd like to buy her husband a boat. And a gentleman who wanted to throw a party at a restaurant and said, I can't afford to pay for everybody's dinner, but this is the restaurant I would like. And how do I tell them that they will be paying for themselves and it would be nice if they all chipped in and bought my dinner, too? And a child who says, my mother really doesn't need presents anymore, so how do I tell people to give her cash? Or a wedding invitation that somebody showed me that said, we're working on our first million, and guess where it's supposed to come from? So with these dreams come the schemes. How can I tell guests that they're expected to pay without appearing to be a cheapskate? What are the rules for having a money tree? Some wedding guests have not sent anything yet. What's a tactful way of reminding them? And what's the polite way to say on the invitation that we would like monetary gifts? You know, I hate to tell them this, but there is no way to avoid looking cheap and greedy while you're shaking people down. And I used to wonder, who's going to hand over money on demand like that? But people do, because they believe it is the correct thing to do. They're blaming etiquette. And I don't even get part of the tag. It's not necessary I don't want to discourage conviviality or generosity, goodness knows. But if you are pressured to buy, sponsor, or contribute to other people's dreams, etiquette does not require you to comply. If you feel the sort of affection for people that makes you want to pay their bills, I don't want to stand in your way. But just don't think that etiquette has anything to do with it. Now, I have another complaint that people don't really bring up as much, but I think they should. And this has to do with a subject that America is extremely prudish about. So squeamish that people will simply not face the facts of life. And I'm not talking about sex. I mean, heaven knows we could use a little more reticence on that subject. I don't want to guess what you did last night, so don't even tell me. I'm talking about age and its indignities. I happen to be the only person in America who was born and has been all my life old at heart. When I was about 8 or 10, my father looked at me and he said, you know, I can just picture you as an old lady with a stick and a high-collared blouse tyrannizing over generations of your descendants. And mind you, I was a little girl in pigtails at the time. And I thought about it and I thought, my daddy understands me. Everybody else considers it shameful to age, so we have this elaborate hoax to pretend it doesn't happen. And if people start greeting you by saying, you look great, you're getting old, because that means I see that you haven't had any debilitative diseases more recently, or you haven't changed a bit. A friend from high school said that to me the other day. He said, you haven't changed a bit. I said, I was the only white-haired girl in high school. And, you know, being addressed as young lady or sweetie or honey or dearie or they don't call us girls anymore. That's changed. Now they call us you guys. It's not much of an improvement. Or if it has to do with personal recollections, then it's people can think it is polite to say, oh, you're not old enough to remember that. And they can't really say it if it's an event in your own life, but like your marriage or when your child was born. But then they will say, well, you must have been a child bride, or were you 11 when you gave birth? And speaking of children, that's your daughter? Why, I thought it was your sister. That's your granddaughter? I thought, please. That sort of thing would drive me to drink, except I know that somebody would say to me, whoa there, young lady, are you old enough to drink? This is all very tedious, but it is supposedly harmless enough. But it's not so harmless when the elderly take it up themselves. Now, I realize that I'm the only elderly person there is. Everybody else is middle-aged. Middle-aged now goes into the 60s, and so apparently the life expectancy is a minimum of 120. We all know we were meant to be immortal, and if we die, it was the doctor's fault, and everybody will explain to your survivors that it's your fault. If you'd taken better care of yourself or had a better mindset, you wouldn't have died. If only medical science could bestir itself to find the cure for aging. The cosmetic companies have found it. I see products labeled anti-aging, and I thought, uh-oh, if I'm not going to age, what am I going to do? And we're in a loop where after middle age, youth comes around again. You know, so, oh, you're 98 years young. Yeah. And the phrase older and wiser is only used in connection with misfortune nowadays. But there are serious etiquette consequences to this thing. It has led to the extraordinary phenomenon of the old being rude to the young because the young are trying to be polite to them. Snapping at someone who offers a seat on the bus, or hurling accusations at any child who has been properly taught to address adults and saying, whoa, you make me feel ancient. And you know, the poor child not only has been taught that and it's been put in doubt, but now has another etiquette problem, which is not saying, but you look ancient. Well, and the children who are told, oh, you can't call them grandma and grandpa because they say they're too young to be grandparents. We've got to call them Bubbles and Buster. You know what? If your children have children, you're old enough to be a grandparent. But so the old are snapping at the young for treating them with respect. And then they wonder why respect is dying out. There are people who are sabotaging the parents who are trying to teach their children to show that kind of respect. And devoted parents now put as much effort into helping their children as those who never doubted that they were more competent than their children, except, of course, when we need their help to get out of our computer problems. That sort of turned the world upside down as far as respect for the elderly. I now show a lot of respect for a kid who can fix my problems. But a lot of well-meant parenting has gone instead into berating others for not teaching manners, berating the television for not having exhibiting perfect manners. Well, it's drama. I mean, even I wouldn't watch television shows about people being polite to one another. You're supposed to have a little conflict in there. It's sports figures and movie stars, right? They have the responsibility for teaching manners to the children and not the parents. And it's left us without a system of precedence. Now, it's true that the ladies first system became outmoded, at least in the professional world. It's rather charming still in the social world, but and people who despise it forget that it was a great improvement on the system of precedence which preceded it, which was ladies never. But we have to have a system of precedence. And a system based on age would make a lot of sense, because with any luck, we'd all get to be to go first. But that would be acknowledging age. So instead, we have the lack of a system, which results in me first and get out of my way. And it's led adults to adopt patterns of behavior that were appropriate only to children. In this area of food, this includes the infant standard, feeding on demand instead of scheduled meal times, and food fussing, which is now a major topic of adult conversation. Old age is not going to be respected until old people regain their own self-respect. You know, it's a bargain with the devil. If you refuse the dignities of age, it's not going to make you young again. It's only going to make you being treated without the dignities. There are a couple of spin-offs of this. One is, which is not direct, but not unrelated. One is compulsory informality, casualness. People will brag, well, I'm always casual. And in the area of clothes, it has led people to deny that there is any symbolic system about clothing. And everybody reads clothing for symbolism, and yet people all deny that it exists. I just dress for comfort, and I dress to express myself. And then when perfectly innocent kids dress like criminals or prostitutes, they're very insulted if people think that's what they are. If you really want to know about symbolism in dress and how it works, commit a terrible crime and hire an extremely good lawyer. And the lawyer will tell you how to dress to symbolize to the jury. I love watching rock stars appear in court looking bandbox fresh with haircuts and smiles and all that. And people, young people now, having been told that the casual standard is the only standard, are starved for some kind of formality, only they don't know how to do it, as you can see from looking at a junior prom. And why is it that a young woman who has never had on a dress or a skirt in her entire life, when she's getting married, suddenly needs a $6,000 dress to wear for 2 hours, and wants to dress everybody else? The wants all the bridesmaids to buy $1,000 dresses and starts getting ideas that, oh, all the guests should be in this color or that, and so on. I get a lot of letters like that. And the other side of the argument is, well, we should judge people by what's inside. Yes, but how do you peek inside of someone you just met? That has not been worked out yet. Another area is names. You remember when, less than a generation ago, first names were used for intimates, for friends, but they were used also by people who expected to be addressed with titles. A boss would expect to be Mr. So-and-so, usually was Mr., but could call the women on the staff by their first names, and African Americans were dressed even in courtroom procedures by their first names. It was an insult, and it had to be leveled out. It has been leveled out, but again, I hate it when the amateur etiquette people get to work. If I had done this, I would say dignity and titles for everybody, and no, they say for nobody. So it's more friendly, even when there's no relationship remotely connected with friendship. I once went to battle with this on the Mayo Clinic that was having doctors, as many doctors do, address their patients by their first names, and yet they were expected to be called doctor. And they said, well, it's friendlier. And I said, well, you know, it really isn't friendly, because among friends, either both of us have our clothes on or both of us have our clothes off. But not just one and one. I taught my smartphone to stop calling me by my first name. It did that. And it when I first got it, I'd seen these advertisements. There was an advertisement that ran that you could take your phone, you push the button, and you say, it was a man saying, "Tell my wife I'll be late," or something like that. So I pushed the button. I said, "Tell my husband to pick me up." And the voice said, "I don't know who your husband is. And matter of fact, I don't even know who you are." So I realized I had to fill in my name. So I did fill in my name, and the next time it was, "Hi, Judith." And I thought, "Oh, no, you don't. You're much younger than I am. I don't even know you. I wouldn't recognize you on the street." So I was in the Apple store, and I said, "I'd like to fix this so it calls me Mrs. Martin." And the genius looked at me like I was crazy. He said, "I don't know how to do that." And I had to figure it out. I had to tell them. And anybody who wants to do it, see me afterwards. I'll tell you how to do it.
You're listening to author and newspaper columnist Judith Martin, also known to her many readers as Miss Manners, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Just as in a system where you have stages of intimacy, and when you suddenly can call someone by their first name because you've married them or something, it's very nice. And I maintain that just as people can say, "Please, I would be very pleased if you called me Judith," you can also say, "I would be very pleased if you would call me Mrs. Martin." Why not? It's my name, and you are equally allowed to give the privileges or to withhold them. Now, the book I have just written showed a new manners problem to me. I was aware of all the problems that come up at workplaces because people write me letters about them. Person in the next cubicle smells, eats disgusting food, talks too loud, dresses wrong, and so on and so on. But finally, it occurred to me what the overall bigger problem is in the workplace. And I had the advantage here of working with my son, who is director of operations at Lyric Opera in Chicago and has had a lot of equally stress-free jobs. Like, he was publisher of the Washington Monthly, national political magazine, at one point, and he worked on healthcare at the White House at one point. So those, you know, no problems come up in any of those fields, certainly not in opera. And he also helped me see the executive point of view, because my only job has been as a ink-stained wretch. And he said, "You're always sympathizing only with the person who's fired. It's not much fun to fire people either. You have to take up management." But anyway, what we realized, the two of us, is that people have, it isn't just the rudeness problem, people have switched manners. So they use social manners at work and business manners in their private lives. So if you want to hire someone for a job, you ask them about their hopes and dreams and their background, and you might take them even out for a nice lunch and get to know them a bit. However, if you would like to have a romantic partner, you take out a classified ad. At most, you give them a cup of coffee and snap judgment, and you really want to know how much money they make. I trace a lot of this confusion to some of America's sweetest and most disastrous ideas. One of them, which is rather an old one, is ladylike behavior. And when women of my generation entered the workforce, which is generally now referred to as when women started to work, well, women started to work in the beginning of time. Poor women have always worked. They're really talking about women rising a little bit above that. we were brought up that there's only one standard of manners. You're either a lady or you're not. And we all know what that means. Whereas a man could be an officer and a gentleman, or a gentleman and a scholar, and he was supposed to have the same gentlemanly-like rules that ladies had for ladylike rules, but not to behave exactly the same in the drawing room as he did on the battlefield, or even in the library. There were two sets of manners, and women went into the workforce, and there's a trace of this left, with the social manners. You don't talk about money. You don't brag. And these are not ways to get ahead on the job, where it is perfectly proper to do these things. I know I got very angry at the Washington Post once where I said, I haven't got a raise in 20 years. I was angry about something else, or I wouldn't have said that. And Ben Bradley, who was the editor, said, you haven't asked for one. Said, the men come in here all the time. And not claiming credit for your work. It's bragging when it's in social life. It's necessary in business life. And another really disastrous idea that started right here in California, although it does show up every few hundred years in other places, is that if you got to know somebody really well, you would love that person. And we would all get along and be friends if only we took down all the barriers and got to know one another. I find this rather puzzling. I mean, whom do you know more intimately than the person you're divorcing? It didn't really, really work, and yet it's still in the workplace that building a team, we should all be friends, and so there are all these fake friends in the workplace, and it's taking up people's time and money. I mean, are you contributing to the temp's engagement party present? And by the way, I see from my letters that people agonize over what to get their coworkers as presents. And Secret Santa, which when I was in college we thought we were too sophisticated for, but it's all over the workplace, what do I get? Whereas for their relatives, what they ask me is, how much is the check for my nephew getting married? What's the going rate for my sister-in-law graduating or getting a PhD and so on? So they're paying their friends and relatives, but getting presents for their colleagues. It's all part of this reversal. And what has disappeared then is, or disappeared from the workplace, is professional manners, where you didn't have to love the person who worked next to you. You had to work cooperatively and cheerfully with that person. The professional manners, as I say, are used socially. And in the workplace, people often ask me, how do I get out of going to this where they're having a birthday party for someone I don't really know them and so on. And I say, have you ever thought of saying I have work to do? That's what you tell your relatives when you, at the last minute, don't go to their weddings or their dinner parties. You say, well, I've got work. But nobody ever says that when they're at work, oddly enough. And then another of these bad ideas, I think, is that it comes from, which again is well meant, is the child rearing of today. The advice that parents give their children is, be yourself. What does that mean? Who would you be if you didn't want to be yourself? It's a very odd instruction. And I notice that when people talk about being themselves, like, oh, I just want to be myself at home, they mean their worst self. They mean, I'm going to behave disgustingly, and nobody can stop me because it's the real me. Perhaps. But we all have multiple selves, and the person who behaves the same in a job interview as when out at a beer bash is going to be in trouble. And the young people are not being told that. They are saying, be yourself. And so, okay, fine. And come in and you put your feet up and you address the interviewer by the first name and you start talking about your romantic problems. there are contexts. And that is now considered being false to oneself to be different in one place than another. So here we are, my son and I. I misunderstood the part about take your children to work, and I thought it was put your children to work. So I wrote a wedding book with my daughter, who, when she was getting married, and reading all the wedding porn. There's a lot of porn put out for. They tell you all these things you have to do, and most of them hideously vulgar and incorrect. And they use the name etiquette to describe them, and then they know that people can't afford it, so they tell you how to shake down your wedding guests and your family in order to do it. But anyway, I wrote this book with her, called Miss Manners' Guide to a Surprisingly Dignified Wedding. And this book, with my son, with the title that is in violation of etiquette's directive to mind your own business. And if the system were working, we wouldn't interfere. But it's not, because the letters that I get, and I get, you know, 50 or 60 emails a day, and a lot of them have to do with work problems. People are not happy. And they have bought into a kind of phoniness, not only that Americans are supposed to despise phoniness. I mean, if anything, we're supposed to be genuine. Not only the phoniness of pretending that your coworkers are your friends, but since there are no titles, pretending there is no hierarchy. And that it's not really a workplace because we can play video games and have little parties and things. As I say, it is not working because people are not happy with it. And inevitably, when it comes to an end, there is a tragedy. And the tragedy is worse if you're fired, of course. And then nobody will look you in the eye because they think it's catching. Or if they talk to you after you're fired, they tell you how much work, more work they have to do because they have to do yours as well, and you're supposed to sympathize. But even people who have had long, successful careers, when they retire, they have not bothered to make friends because they had all these fake friends. And I first noticed this. I used to, for my sins, cover embassy social life in Washington years ago. And we called it the garbage run because it was a lot of food. Every once in a while, an ambassador or another high-ranking official would say, who is retiring, would decide to stay in Washington. They say, we have so many friends here. And then not long after, it was, our friends have deserted us. Well, they didn't have any friends. They had a very posh social life, sponsored, very luxurious, sponsored by governments for the purpose of bringing people together who had various aspects of power. And when they retired, they no longer had that, so they were no longer part of that scene. But this has now trickled down to everywhere because, as you know, work has become a 24-hour job. There's, if you're not actually there, there's the email. There's the texting, there's the checking in from wherever you are on vacation, at home, or whatever you're doing. And people have bought into this. Obviously, they want jobs and they want to make money. I'm trying also to reach the people who make these decisions. And I think in the end, it's worse because you get a lot of disgruntled people who are not happy with their lives because they really don't have lives. They just have working lives. And they're constantly being disillusioned when their pals turn out to be rivals or bosses. And at the same time, in what there is of social life, where how do you do has been replaced by what do, there is this ranking. And apparently nobody feels confident enough of the exaltedness of the position they hold to relax about this. So everybody has to advertise themselves, write ads for themselves on the social media and tell you how wonderful they are. Social media, I love it, killed the meaning of the word friend and now it's killing the meaning of the word social. Your social life, mostly virtual, is where you troll for admiration and advantages nowadays. Well, and by the way, my son and I are far from minimizing the difficulties that people have with this kind of setup. Both of us had around-the-clock jobs when we had small, or he has small children. He has a 2-year-old and a working wife, and we know how difficult this is. And when he and his sister were growing up, I always had a full-time job. Nobody has sufficient time for work and family. And we're still operating on the 19th century Industrial Revolution system of the division of spheres between men and women. That the man, all the man has to do is earn the money. The woman has to run the household, run civic life, philanthropy, run their social life, and everything else. And now that she has to make money too, that sphere is pretty much deserted. And it's hard on everybody. And systematic changes are needed. And they're mighty slow in coming. So in the meantime, we're offering this book as a guide to the principles and the day-to-day practices and how to deal with the smelly person in the next cubicle of coping with this ghastly situation, at least unhampered by the phony assumptions and the false obligations that are making things worse. And that way, our hope is that you will find time to listen to the hopes and dreams of your family and friends and not be embarrassed to ask for more money. Thank you.
My name is Simone Carré, and I wanted to ask you if you're ever going to write a book on business travel or etiquette for travel, something along those lines.
That's an interesting question, because I spend a lot of time in Venice. I once wrote a book about Venice. And the manners are slightly different. They're very charming. They're very polite people. And they explain that they're polite people because they can't get in the car and go off after they have an altercation like you Americans can. We keep seeing people in the street. We're all walking. But it varies. And I've looked at a lot. There are a lot of books like that. And I've looked at them. And I keep finding mistakes. And this is not, this is really out of my own experience. My father was with the UN. We lived abroad in various places, and I loved to travel. And I sympathize with the people who made those mistakes, because you have to really know a culture very well in order to know what the nuances of etiquette are. And there are a few broad things that you should study before you go someplace, just as you should learn bits of the language. But it's very difficult to really get inside and get the nuances. And I have them for Italy, I have them for America, a little bit for other places I've lived, but I can't do a comprehensive book on that.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author and newspaper columnist Judith Martin, also known to her many readers as Miss Manners. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
My dear Mrs. Martin, it is a pleasure finally seeing you after
Thank
all
you.
The years I have read your books. I, for one, believe that civility perhaps might have a chance to make the world more, not only pleasant, but peaceful. And I lament when I answer the telephone at home and someone blurts out my given name or sending an invitation with an RSVP and being completely ignored. I have come to the conclusion that most people are not reading you, and certainly what used to be the sacred temple of manners, the home, is long gone. Therefore, as you once said, why don't you tell in your sweet little village, namely Washington, that these things should be taught at school? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your kind words. And of course, I agree with you, except on the idea of teaching it in school. School teachers are trying to teach children to read and write, to know some history, to know some mathematics, to know some geography, to put the burden on them and not on the parents, I think is unfair. Now, a schoolroom should have its rules, and that is one way of teaching manners. I always envy judges who can make absolute etiquette rules and haul you off to jail if you disobey them. And teachers have a little bit of authority like that. But it is the parents who need to do that because it is a constant job. And what we have now, and I was involved in my children's schools very much, and it isn't just the underprivileged parents and overwrought parents who are not doing this job. A lot of it is the very privileged parents who do not want to say no to their children, who do not cooperate with the teachers because if the child is in trouble, they act as the child's lawyer instead of the teacher's colleague. And yes, teachers, bless their hearts, they go into the profession because they care. Heaven knows it's not for the money. And I would not put that burden on them other than to run a classroom where rules are observed. But in this, my children's school, which I also went to, is a private school. And in Washington, the public schools are not as good as they can should be. And people were desperate to get their children into private school at any cost because your child could, frankly, end up dead, not just ignorant. In the public school system at one time. And they would school their little toddlers to read or to do all kinds of things. And we said, we'll teach them to read. We're a school. Teach them some manners. And then people would sneer and they'd say, well, teach a 3-year-old manners? Yes. You teach them to sit down and be quiet for at least a few minutes. You teach them you don't hit people you disagree with. A few, you know, 3-year-old manners, and then you teach them 4-year-old manners, and so on. So I'm totally with you. I didn't mean to jump on you over that one thing. But yes, manners must be taught to the young. It is so unfair to them not to teach them. When I started doing this, I thought I would be writing for a few old cranks like myself. And not true. It's mostly questions are for young people, those same young people whose only instruction from their parents was to be themselves. And they don't know how to handle different situations. Because as I always say, it's like throwing a child out on the soccer field and saying, well, there aren't any rules, just do your best, you know, be yourself. You're going to get killed. So, but I'm with you entirely, and thank you for your kind words.
Hi, Ms. Manners. I'm Michael, and I've got a question about hats. So I like wearing hats. When can I put them on? When do I need to take them off? And is a baseball hat any different than like this kind of a hat?
It's the rules were very strict about gentlemen and hats, and they sort of got forgotten because a whole generation that's now middle-aged or more didn't want to wear hats. Men didn't want to wear hats because their fathers wore hats, and they didn't want to look old. And now hats are coming back, and as you say, the baseball cap is everywhere. The rule is that a gentleman removes his hat indoors. I'm sorry to keep coming back to Venice, but that's my other venue, and I'll be there in 3 weeks. There were some American tourists who were attacked in St. Mark's Basilica because were wearing baseball caps, and young Italians who attacked them interpreted that as sneering at their religion. Because it's an arbitrary thing, and women could keep their hats on. And, well, for that matter, all of etiquette is arbitrary. Manners, the principles are eternal and the same. But as you know, a man takes off his hat in a church, but he puts on a hat in the synagogue. And the intent is to show respect, so it's the same. But if you violate it, you offend people. And if everybody in the world had forgotten that a gentleman is supposed to take his hat off, you could leave it on. But they haven't.
Yes. Today, I checked into a doctor appointment routine. I have two names, Marcia Rosenbaum, and I'm being called Miss Marcia. This happens to me all the time, and it drives me nuts. What is up with that?
Well, in the South, that would be considered what you should call someone who is close but not total intimate, or what you could teach your children to call a close family friends. But I don't think that that's what is intended around here. They're trying to compromise. They probably run into the anger of some people who didn't like being called by their first names. As I said earlier, I think you can say very nicely how you would like to be called. And you should do that. Because, again, it's probably by people who think it's flattering to you. And it's not. Yeah.
Briefly, with thanks, parenthetically, I do think that the middle age extends well into the 60s. But
well, I envy you.
I'm troubled, personally, with my conclusion that the word respect, the idea of respect, is uncomfortably close to the idea of fear. And I'm looking for a different, more appropriate word. Civility strikes me as attractive. Do you know of a website that has to do with a civility movement?
No, not particularly. But I want to quarrel with your definition of respect. We treat people we admire with respect. Mr. Wallenberg was a great person who was respected all over the world for what he did. It's not just fear, it's admiration too. And some of it is just because we recognize a certain hierarchy, and part of it has to do with age. And people who say, well, why should I respect grandma the way she behaves? Because she's your grandmother, that's why. please don't put down respect, but I'm all for civility.
What's the best way to say I'm hosting an event, but I would not like gifts?
That is such a sympathetic problem. I get it all the time. And I have so many questions from people who say, I'm hosting, and how do I tell people they have to pay for themselves, and I do want gifts, that I love the people who feel this way. And I'm very sorry to have to say, you're not supposed to be thinking even about getting presents. And if you say, I don't want them, here's what happens. I get letters from people who say, does that mean they want cash? Or, well, I suppose I should bring it anyway. And it doesn't do any good, so you might as well not do it. But you are not supposed to be thinking of that. If you want to get around it on a particular occasion, if you want to have a party on your birthday, for instance, here's how you do it. You just have a party. And then when you're there, you say, I'm so glad you all came. It's my birthday, and I wanted to be with you. And they'll all say, why didn't you tell us? We would have brought you something. But that's the way they don't have to.
Mrs. Martin, I'm so happy to be here, and I have a question about whether I did the correct thing. About 5 years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and it was the inauguration, and I was driving in a car with my husband, and I saw you walking down the street, and I said to my husband, oh my God, it's Judith Martin, stop the car. And my husband stopped the car, and he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I think I'm going to run down the street after her and tell her how much I love her work and how wonderful she looks. And And I said, do you think that would be weird? And he said, well, what do you think Miss Manners would say you should do?
Well, Miss Manners does not think it would be weird at all.
Oh.
If you remember, it was a bitterly cold day.
Yes.
And we all had to walk for hours and hours because transportation was all choked up and everything. And on that bitterly cold day, it would have warmed my heart.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, we did. We tried. I erred on the side of caution. I said, well, I think she would think we should keep driving. So we did. So I'm so glad I finally got to ask you, and I will run home and tell my husband. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. I have a great fear of the possibility that they're somehow going to change the rules or the laws so that everybody will be able to talk on cell phones on planes. What do you think about that? And if it happens, what do you do to discourage the persons next to you from talking on their phones?
The airlines, I mean, it probably will happen, yes. And the airlines, in fact, some planes already have, they had phones built in that for $1,000 a minute you can say goodbye to the person you just said goodbye to on the ground. But they're going to end up probably unbearably slowly doing what they did with the smoking situation, which was first everybody could smoke all over the planes, and then they had smoking sections where the smoke was all in the back and it wafted up to the front. And then finally it got banned altogether. Whether they'll ever get to the ban thing, I don't know. But the trains do this now. They have a quiet car and where you're not allowed to use your cell phone. And I don't know how they'll work it out on planes, but I just came in on a plane this morning, and I've concluded for the millionth time that they're really not interested in your comfort. So I don't have much faith in it.
One of the things that just drives me nuts is in a restaurant where you get a family that sits down with younger children, and they think they're home. And the little kid bangs the spoon on the table for 20 minutes, and the mother just sits there because the child does it at home. And they look at you like, well, it's a child. What do you expect? And God forbid you go over and say, you know, that's really irritating me. I came to have a nice dinner, not to listen to your children scream at the top of their lungs, bang the table. And if you do that, you could get shot. So how do you approach that situation? And I'm not talking about a coffee shop. I'm talking about a fine dining restaurant where children are allowed to run up and down the aisles. Waiters are tripping over them, they're screaming, and you can't even hear your own self talk because of the noise around you.
And I'm horrified by the fact that the children do this at home. What a home life these people must have. Direct confrontation is not a good idea, and not only because you're going to get shot, which you probably are. You go to the restaurateur. And you say, I like this restaurant very much, but it's unbearable, and I'm not having a nice dinner here. And either he finds you a place to go, or he kidnaps the child, or you never go there again. But direct confrontation is really a bad idea. Even I don't go around scolding people. It's rude.
Yes, Mrs. Manners, it's an honor to be here tonight with you.
Thank you.
And I just want to tell you, I have twin boys, and they're 14, and they're constantly on their phones. And when we go out to dinner with a group of family, I always tell them, give me your phones, because I think you're in a restaurant. This is a time to communicate with family member and friends. And then I always have someone intervening and saying, oh, let them be, you know, they're not bothering anyone, and you're so strict and this and that. And I just hate that someone's putting me in that position, first of all, in front of my kids and challenging me with my choices. And I have my kids give me their phones anyway.
Good for you. Yes, there are a lot of people who try to sabotage any child rearing that they see. The explanation to your children and to these people who are interfering is, I feel sorry for them, too. They have a terrible mother who's very strict, but that's the only mother they have, and those are the rules.
Hi. It's great to finally see you in person.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was very enlightening. And but I do have a minor quibble. Your point about the clothing was that you can't know someone upon first meeting them, so you have to have a code to judge them by. What about the option of suspending judgment, or at least until they open their mouth and say a few words and judge them by that?
And also, maybe I didn't make clear, context is important. I'm not against casual dressing. I'm against casual dressing on formal occasions or professional occasions. Yes, you judge people by many things. Before I was in this rather bizarre profession, I was a film and drama critic. And how do you judge drama? Costume, gesture, speech, all of those things. And yes, I'm not saying clothes are the most important thing. But if someone, this did not happen, but if someone had been sitting shirtless next to me in the air, at the airplane, I don't think I would have drawn him out to find out what kind of person he was. I would have asked for another seat. You know?
Good evening, Ms. Manners.
Good evening.
I entertain a lot, and there's something that I've noticed is sort of like a new fad, and it's driving me crazy, and that's when dinner guests sort of spontaneously decide when to start clearing the dishes. They not only clear them, but they scrape them at the table. And I've actually had situations where I say, oh, no, please, I'll take care of that in just a few minutes, and they persist. And even trying to take plates where the people are still eating. and then I say, no, really, there's no place in the kitchen, I'll take care of it. And they still persist. So I need some way to actually just stop them dead in their tracks.
Tell me when you're giving a dinner party, I'm going to come over and I'm going to say, sit down. you have to be firm with them. And, you know, they I think you're putting it very charmingly and very nicely, and I think they think you don't mean it. So you have to tell them you mean it. There's very little, if you may have noticed, reciprocation to people who entertain. And so there is grown up this idea that, well, they'll do a little something while they're there, or they'll bring a dish or something, and then they don't have to invite you back. I don't know if this is the case there, but these habits have become ingrained, and you have to be firm with them. And you are the host. You're in charge. Pretend you're the judge in the courtroom. Nicely.
Thanks to all of you for being here tonight. Thanks most of all to Judith Martin, Miss Manner.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author and newspaper columnist Judith Martin, also known to her many readers as Miss Manners. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature writer Andrew Solomon. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.